In this podcast, we will cover proteins, globular proteins in particular, but how they're made. So we'll discuss how they're hooked together from a whole series of some 22 amino acids. When I grew up, it was 20, but now it's 22 amino acids. So don't worry about that too much. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. Now, there needs to be several layers of context. The last podcast you perhaps listened to was about blood, and we're going along about the various components of blood and how there's a whole bags of proteins in the cells, and there's individual little globular proteins in the plasma, the non-cell part of the blood, and we're looking at that. Now, unfortunately, I had to stop instantly when my son came up wanting a driver's lesson, and I'll just talk about that driving lesson for a bit to put you into the layers of context. I'll give you three layers of context here. It's fairly important that I stop, do the driver's lesson, because when that's finished, I had to cook dinner, and so if I delayed at any point, it would stop the process of life going on. In Australia, up here in New South Wales, we have to do 120 hours, or the students have to do 120 hours of driving, 100 hours in on normal roads, and 20 hours in at nighttime driving. And there's a fairly thick logbook to go through where you detail every drive, and there's also a front section where you sign and date that you've taught different areas. So there's things like off-road driving. They have to actually go through a hazard, a computerized hazard identification test, where they're supposed to be tested. And so it's sort of a different world going through it in various courses. So you have to go through and do it. Now, with the last generation of logbooks, you now have smartphone apps with GPS tracking on you. So you press your button, I'm starting now, and GPS knows where you've gone and tests everything. I suppose someone looks at all that data. So that's driving lessons, and I have had to stop fairly instantly. This is the next day of picking up from it, where I've discussed blood. I was going up to blood to get into proteins, to get into drugs, to get into a whole series of things like that. That's one layer of context. The other layer of context is why I'm practicing podcasting and explaining things. That I've had a heart condition, been off work for a while. As a scientist, you're put up, held up to a much higher standard, or you're held between two things. You have to explain things which are scientifically correct, i.e. you can't actually go down the simple path of just following the textbook. But then on the other hand, since you're back, there's people in the room inspecting you. Like very first lesson after a heart condition, you have people there connecting and assessing and making sure that you're not explaining things too deeply. So in order to get ahead of the game in that case, I decided, look, I'll start podcasting. I'll start off slowly, try and get things done, and try and sort of narrow up to get to podcasting. And it strikes me a little bit of, I don't know if anyone has seen Amadeus, the movie of Mozart, where they say, oh, look, the problem is too many notes. That is not too many written notes, but too many notes in the music. So too much information, too much factual information. And it is indeed a problem to actually get all the facts together, to get all the information together and coherently. It does require practice, so thank you very much in listener audience listening to it. The third layer of context is my heart condition. I had a dodgy valve, a bicuspid valve, and they've replaced it by cutting me open and cutting the aorta open and cutting out the old valve and putting in a new valve. The new valve is a mechanical valve. It's a little aircraft valve, and I quite literally say it's an aircraft. It was first developed as a valve inlet for the V1 German buzz bomb, that those little louvers used to close when the explosive pulse went up, explode, and push the exhaust out the back. This is the buzz bombs, which famously used to drop over Britain before they worked out how to stop them. And then They've sort of obviously downsized that to about an inch, and then it's made out of pencil lead graphite. So initially, when you have the valve first machined, you could actually go to a piece of paper and just draw with it, because it's just graphite, not quite, because of the actual graphite you use in pencils. I think it's got a clay mixture with it, so it comes out smoothly, so you can actually write with it. But indeed, it is soft graphite, and you could actually just easily get in your hand and crush it. And so what they've done is they've coated it with a isotropic pyrolytic carbon. This is carbon gunk. And this is a sort of a crystal carbon, a chaotic graphite carbon crystal, which interlocks. So it's sort of like super graphite fiber. It's like a carbon engineering. And this came from, I think, the US definitely developed it for the re-entry cone of ballistic missiles. This new material was a fantastic, lightweight, high-temperature material. And it's got the strength of diamond, but it's also flexible. And, of course, it's the obvious choice for a heart valve material, in that it lasts a very long time. So you can get the biosynthetic ones. This is made out of the outer layer of cow and pig hearts. They sew it up, the membranes there. It's actually not inside the heart, it's the actual outer material membrane. It's got the right properties, but they only last 17 years at max, and if you're in stress situations, sometimes much less. So I picked the aircraft mechanical one with the good quantum mechanical surface, the high purity surface. It's also the pyrolytic carbon is also used at the back of mobile phones because it's got excellent thermal transmission properties. It's not through it, but along the surface. So your component produces some heat. It goes into the pyrolytic carbon and then goes out to the edge of your phone. So I think you'll find a lot of phones nowadays, a lot of devices nowadays have a layer of this pyrolytic carbon. But the end result for it is that the lifetime between failures, which of course you'd look up immediately if you've got a heart valve. So for the biosynthetic one, it's 17 years, but you factor it in and you get 8 years before they have to open you up again. And the mechanical one is 10 million patient years. They believe it's up around 10 million patient years. So that's an obvious one to go. While I'm talking about this is that you get very interested in blood because there's clots that form around this material. So you can't get everything. So there's clots which form around it. Clots, it's always on the edge, your blood's on the edge working out. It doesn't take a lot to trigger a clot, you know, it's not going to be any doubt. It's got a hair trigger on forming clots, so it forms from the outside of this. So I'm obviously interested in clotting factors in blood, and they feed you this wonderful molecule called warfarin molecule. It's a really interesting molecule. I may get onto it at some stage, and that actually slots into the protein of your blood. This is the ambulin, this globular protein, so I'm interested in that. The other aspect of the ambulin plays an important process in getting the drug from your tummy to your liver, so that's an important thing to know. The other aspect is with big operations, you start to swell, and with this other aspect, valve's got a big leak on the outside, and so it's mucking up my blood and I'm beginning to swell up a little bit. So I'm very interested in the water drawing properties of this ambulin process, so you really go into it. So if you've ever been into a big operation or had a car accident or anything like that where there's a lot of trauma, or you happen to be malnourished, so there's a couple of things. Don't have a car accident, have a big operation, and be malnourished, you'll probably swell up a lot. And edema, I think in pregnancies, there's this swelling up as well. So it's a general problem of getting your blood to draw the water out of your body. So there's that level of interest. But without, I'll just go back over what I've just I covered three layers of interest. The immediate context where I had to break off last time for a driving lesson gave you a little bit of a view of what happens in Australia. Another layer of context why I'm doing podcasts and improving my speaking ability. So hopefully I'll listen back to my early podcasts, my most recent podcasts, and see an improvement and actually factor it into actually producing better quality lessons and discussing. The third layer of context is how I'm interested in this area. Being a molecular physicist with some quantum physics background, you look at this and you start to actually work your way through the physics of your heart valve, but also the physics of the blood. And so without further ado, we're going to get into proteins. So you've got globular proteins, which means spherical proteins. So this proteins actually bundle up to be a sphere. Now, we're going to have to take you into a journey to actually look at what proteins are. Proteins are absolutely fantastic things. So with some basic think 20 proteins that humans use, we actually pretty much build everything in our body out of protein. So if it's a machine, let's add it up. You've got some bones, some calcium build up, some calcium phosphate crystals for your teeth. They're not bones, your teeth are different, they're crystal outcrops. You've got sort of fat and fat, double fat layers, which form the layers of your cells, but pretty much everything else, the actual cellular skeleton and this the materials, the machines inside your cells are all proteins, and all your food is proteins. So proteins are the major thing, and they're made up of 20 amino acids or 22 amino acids. So we have to do it here, and one of these proteins, the ambulin, is albinum. It comes from albino, white, egg white, same stuff as egg white. There's about 5% in your blood or less. It's 55% plasma juice, and 5 to 10% of that is this globular protein. Also in there is water and other things. So there's a lot of misconceptions that drinking a lot of water will lead to your swelling. It can, but it's, I suppose, reducing the water intake is not particularly the way to go. So we've got these proteins. Now, I think the way that I'd like to think about it is, you've got the Pandora bracelets. You've got these other weird things that I've only found out just called troll beads, but if you can imagine a string of pearls, beads, not in a circle, they're a long chain. All proteins are chains, so all linear chains, and they're put together with links, and the links have sort of little charms going off them, and what happens is the charms attract to each other, and it actually folds up as a neat thing. These from each link has a charm on it, which we call a side chain with denoted letter R, and each link of an amino, so of a protein, is an amino acid. So if you put a few amino acids together, link them all together with their little charms or side chains together, just a few, say up to 20, that's not really a protein, we call that a peptide. But as it gets on to hundreds or even thousands of chains long, links, amino acids long, that's a protein. So I'm just going to drop the word peptide, because peptide's the story of, so you can have an amino acid, and if two or more amino acids hook together, that's a peptide, and if you get sufficient up that it's actually something that's useful, you get a protein. Now for every an amino acid is an amine an amine group, which is NH2, which hooks onto a carbon, and that central carbon is hooked onto its charm or side chain. So that's all the beautiful stuff of that protein, which is hooked on to another carbon, which has an oxygen and an alcohol on it. It's an acid, carbolic or carbon acid. If you'd like it, that's sort of like it's a little Lego block. And if you imagine the nitrogen is the electron donor or the actual circular stud of the block, and the receiver is the acid section of the block, so it sticks together. There's sort of an amino acid is sort of like a Dr. Jekyll and Hyde thing. On the amino is basic, the acidic part is acidic, and so it's an acid base and does its own little acid base reaction. It's sort of like a crazy little thing. So these are like Lego blocks with a charm hanging off, and you just plug these Lego blocks into a long, long line of Lego blocks. If you've ever played Lego and you've seen the Lego movie, Master Builder type of thing, but say if they're all those 4x4 and you can only stack them on together, so you stack them all together, and you can the only choice you have is what block you have and what order you put. But all proteins are structurally the same. Every single protein is structurally the same. It's a long amino acid chain, and we'll talk a bit about it. So this chain is called the backbone of the protein, and normally you'd say, "Oh, if this is a long stack, all proteins would be long sticks." So in fact, they do. All proteins start off as long sticks. Then they go in the cell to the folding factory, and so they start to fold your protein up, and it's sort of like origami. It folds up the bigger a Lego block for building the cytoskeleton. It folds up a little leg for walking. It's got little robots inside your cells which walk around. They fold up little mini robots and proteins which are cells. The only things which aren't made of proteins are the actual protein factories themselves. The mitochondria are not actually made out of proteins. They're actually made out of RNA. So what happens is the DNA produces RNA, and it produces ribosomal RNA, and that ribosome folds up to be the first little factory. So that's the one exception to everything's made out of protein. So obviously your DNA isn't, and your mitochondria, which not the mitochondria, what am I calling ribosome, RNA, ribosome. Strike out everything I said about mitochondria. I'm just getting old. It's the ribosome. Little components which actually manufacture your proteins. We'll get onto it later on, but forget that for the moment. We've got the idea of how do you get your amino acid to stick together. So your amino acid starts off with a nitrogen, a carbon with a side chain, and a carbon with an oxygen on it. That's the important thing to know. And so what happens is all proteins go like this. They go with a nitrogen, a carbon with a side chain, carbon with an oxygen, and then the next one, a nitrogen, carbon with a side chain, carbon with an oxygen, and then the next one, a nitrogen, a carbon with a side chain, a carbon with an oxygen. Now, the carbon with the oxygen has got the thing is that the oxygen loves electrons. And so what happens is that you get your two amino acids together and you have the nitrogen of your second one lining up with the carbon and oxygen of your first one. And the receptor hole for the nitrogen is full with a alcohol and oxygen and hydrogen, and that's stuck in there, and the in the right condition where they're pushed together and massaged together, they're squeezed up, the oxygen and hydrogen leave, the electron which is free from the nitrogen goes up, and gets sucked into the carbon, forming a link, forming a bond, and gets pulled in by the oxygen. So just go through it again. You get your amine, nitrogen, carbon with a side chain, or a charm, if you'd like to call it, an R symbol. The next one is carbon with an oxygen, which it normally, before it's ready to bond, it's got an oxygen and an OH. The OH gets kicked off, and the hydrogen of the next nitrogen gets kicked off, and that nitrogen clicks together. So it goes click, 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 and yes, so your the word actually is, forgets. I've got to actually think of the actual word for the actual component, the RNA little submachine which sits out there. That's an M word. It's gone into my head. This is the problem of doing everything off the top of your head. I should have notes to make sure I remember everything. But at any rate, what happens is that this polymerizes. It actually sticks together, and if you imagine that packaging you throw away, the packaging you throw away is the water. And so when a protein is put together, it's all these amino acids get put together, you get water cast off all the time, and it sticks together with this long thing. And as you produce it along, this it gets folded, and gradually, if you're not too skillful, you can fold up I'm not joking, a pair of legs. So inside your cells, all over your cells, there's proteins which are made for skeletons, which are little highways, and little pairs of legs which actually walk around your cell. So there's quite interesting. There's scaffolding inside your cell. And so as a quantum physicist, as I understood what was going on, I just couldn't, you know, it was just jaw-dropping. So look it up. There's these little legs. I think if you really want a good animation of it, there's a Harvard group which has a YouTube called The Inner Life of Cells. So these are all these proteins, and they're made in a long chain. It goes to a protein folding factory, which is called the Golgi apparatus. It folds the protein up, and what was a long line gets folded up, and in this case into a ball. So that's your globular cluster. Now there's a few, look, there's 20 amino acids, and we're just going to talk about them really quickly so we've got a bit of a view of them. I sort of like looking at them from time to time, sort of thinking about them, and there's some which people say, oh, what's that? Amino acid, no one knows about it, doesn't really matter. And to be sure, there are some fairly amazing amino acids. There's ones with lots of hydrogen bonds at the end. There's ones with sulfur in it. They're interesting ones. So there's odd ones with sulfur. There's one with aromatic compounds. So if you make a loop of carbon and start removing hydrogens, they actually forms a little double bonds, sort of hydrogen poor aromatic. Why it's aromatic? Because it smells, you know, it's associated with odor. I don't know why they call it that, but these little loops in it. So there's lots of interesting in these, which you call charms. So going nitrogen, carbon with a charm, carbon with an oxygen, nitrogen, carbon with a charm, carbon with an oxygen, then the next nitrogen. And the role of that oxygen is to suck the electron off that nitrogen, not actually really put, but create a attraction force for that bond to form. And when it forms, it casts, in the forming of that bond, it removes the additional hydrogen, which is in the nitrogen, and OH, which is in the stuck in that acid group, and it pulls it away. And just to go back, it's an acid-based reaction, a polymer reaction, and really to go in it, you've got really, I can think of probably five acid-base theories, is including the Lavoisier's, Lavoisier's first oxygen theory, and then Arrhenius' theory, which is your classic one, which is taught in schools about H plus and OH minus, and then Lowry Bronsted, which is the hydrogen proton donor, and then the Lewis theory, which is the electron one. So if you really need to know all those theories to get your mind around it. If you think of one of the theories, you get stuck. Probably Lewis theory is the most powerful one because it sort of describes why that hydrogen, that oxygen above the carbon is a bit like an islet. It means it's a bit like this little circular bit, and the nitrogen's like the hook. It sort of hooks in there. I'm just trying to give you a view on it. Getting back to some of the amino acids, asparic acid, the simplest one. So the ones that really stand out to you is an amino acid which looks as so it's got two acids on it. So on its side chain is another acid. So it goes amine, carbon with a side chain, amino acid, or carbon with an oxygen. So the side chain, when the side chain is just one or two carbons and then another acid, which is an oxygen and OH minus, you say, well, that's got to be interesting. And they're the ones that were discovered earliest. And asparic acid, which sort of, asparagus. Oh, that's what asparic acid is made from asparagus. And indeed, that's what they did. They got asparagus, crushed it up, and got asparagus juice, and that's the simplest amino acid, which is asparagus juice, asparagus acid, and there's a huge market for it. And you go, what's going on? What is the huge market? Because asparic acids, this is the amino acid, which is made from asparagus juice, absorbs enormous amount of water, and you guessed it, there's a multi-million-dollar market for it in diapers and feminine hygiene. I don't know, I think there must obviously be a food additive, but they don't use silica gel or anything like that. So it's these great things, and it's great in making, I suppose one of the things, if you want to make something biodegrade, you want it to actually swell with water and blister and stuff like that. So there's a huge market for them. And the US, who are interested in building steel and aluminium, the rest of the world are off building these other odd things for it. So asparic acid. The next one up, which is the same thing, but with a few more carbons in it, and please look at this up, is glutamic. I can't pronounce it. I've only ever read it. Monosodium glutamate. It's glutamate, sorry, it's glutamatic acid. Now, MSG, this is the one that people throw in their food. It's sort of like a salt they throw in the food. It's a very basic thing. It's one of the most common amino acids in the body. There's actually a sizable fraction of you is glutamate, and monosodium glutamate is the salt of the acid. So like hydrochloric acid, if you add sodium hydroxide to it, you'll get table salt. So if you've got glutamic acid and you add sodium hydroxide to it, you will get monosodium glutamate. That is one sodium. I don't know why they call it monosodium. I suppose you could get thinking about it, you could actually, because there's two acid groups, so you could get bisodium. You could really go for a monosodium glutamate. That is discovered early in the 20s, and I'm just going off memory, that Japanese scientists discovered it. And this is, I suppose I'll finish off here. This is a, the actual amino acid you can taste. So you have the four school grade tastes, which is you can taste salt, you can taste sugar, both important in your diet. You don't want too much salt, and you want sugar, so it's sweet, I suppose. It's good value. I think we've evolved to taste sugar because that's in fruit. So when fruit is good. It's good. We basically have evolved to taste good fruit. You know, we're coming down from the trees and we're going around to taste good fruit. We've also evolved to taste acid, which is sour, or acid, sour, and base is bitter. This is basically, food is toxic. It tends to be bitter. And I've got to remember, I just call it glutamate. there is a proper word for it, beginning with U. There's a fifth taste, but of course it hasn't reached it into our textbooks too much. And that's glutamate, and that's the taste of meat. It's got a meaty taste, and soy sauce is glutamate. Got a glutamate content. It's sort of like meat juice. Vegetable meat juice is soy sauce. I'm sorry for making it a bit sad about it. And of course, if you can shortcut that by adding actual physical chemical to your cooking, which is monosodium glutamate. And there's a whole series of these, what I call charms, or amino acids. They're sort of like Lego blocks which go together. And just to put to summarize again, every protein in your body is just one long chain of amino acids, different amino acids. Your DNA selects it. Sort of, it's got the blueprint, the plans, the Lego plans in there. And so it sort of sends out the print for saying, I want so many of these proteins produced, and if it mucks it up, it just can rip it apart. So yeah, the great thing about it is that when it makes too many of one protein, it will go up, digest it into amino acids, and then the amino acids soup of these 20 amino acids will float around the cell to be rebuilt in it for another thing. So it's like a Lego kit. You can rebuild it and repurpose it. The important thing is that you have the hook, the carbon with the charm on it, the side chain, then the carbon with the eye to go in, to suck in your hook with the oxygen to pull it up. So I hope you get it there. Then you've got the angling. They don't go as Lego blocks. You can imagine as rotating Lego blocks with an angle on those Lego blocks. You've had those toys, snake toys, which you can bend and can get into any shape. These are a snake with snakes made out of beads with the actual interface at an angle, so you can rotate them and they can go through different angles. Now, this is all quantum mechanics, those angles and the actual behavior of everything and how electrons get sucked up through the molecules. This is a great quantum mechanics. And so it is true that a good fraction of your body, I don't know how many liters of blood, there's probably a cup full of egg white, basically albumin in your body, and this egg white, it's a simple protein, and this simple protein in your blood actually goes around and starts to draw water out of your body, so it stops you swelling up and bloating. So I suppose you when you die, this stops working, your body bloats. That's what you wonder. Also the bacteria at work would be at work then, and so this is also got heaps of these charms, and so your drug can actually be sucked into this protein and actually then travel protected as a sort of an envelope into different organs, can go through with it. So that's all very interesting. I've hoped that I can describe that. Obviously, I want to talk about some of the very interesting drug molecules in a bit later. So that's summarized, and I hope that this has been entertaining and useful. So in the meantime, keep on doing science.